You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Yes, you are tuned into The Wire. Kia ora. Welcome. It's Monday, the 9th of October. Ko jo Thomas Toko Engawa, and I'm joined in studio with producers Sam, Jack, and Leonard. We're a quartet at the moment.
So we hello. Have
a pretty on. Well,
sorry, hi, I just Sam. Came out of the blue there.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. Hi.
Hi.
we've got a very full on show because of the large quantity of producers, which is quite nice. So on the show today, Jack Marshall has a chat with astrobiologist Petra Sweater about her studies on bringing bacteria into spacecrafts as well as other planets. Instead of talking to James Shaw from the Green Party today, we're talking to the newest party member, Gourez Garamam. We're having a wee panel about the recent article Duncan Garner made complaining about immigration and Kmart lines. This will take place with news director Lillian Hanley and Auckland University lecturer Neil Curtis. We also have a report on the dropping rates of tertiary enrollments where we speak to the general public as well as Jonathan Yee from NZUSA about this. Unfortunately, today we don't have Southern Cross as Kendall Hutt is not available. But if you have anything you'd like to add throughout the show, give us a bell. Text us on 53955, give us a call on 309-3879 and just say hello. We always like to hear your thoughts on these things. So first up on the show is Jack's chat about bacteria in space.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
So there's been a recent study on bacteria in space. Bacteria from the Earth can be potentially harmful to other planets and the climate within space stations themselves. When astronauts start their travels, they bring a certain amount of bacteria into space stations where it has a unique environment to grow. Jack Marshall talked to astrobiologist Petra Sweater about her studies on this, and he started off by getting her to explain who she is and what her role in the study was.
I did my degree in biology. And then I suddenly get to meet a NASA scientist, an ESA scientist. So she did. She was one of my supervisors, and she basically offered me to do my diploma thesis in her lab. And I basically started working on spaceflight-associated microbial communities. And that was basically my first step into astrobiology. And from then on, I basically consider myself an astrobiologist. And after that, I did my PhD at the German Aerospace Center in Cologne, affiliated also with the University of Regensburg, where I was working on the Mars 500 project.
Amazing. So this study you're looking at how microorganisms kind of adapt in a confined conditions on an aircraft. So this almost sounds like a horror movie or something. So would you give us a little kind of rundown of what you've found in your study?
We were interested in the microbial load diversity and the dynamics in this confined habitat. Confined habitat in this case is the Mars 500 facility, where they simulated for the first time a full duration flight to Mars with a stay of around 30 days on Mars, and then basically the return flight. And so far there have been basically short-term studies in confined habitats, but ours was the first comprehensive long-term microbiome study. And we basically had no idea how this long-term confinement influences the microbial community, and therefore basically we wanted to understand how the microbes disperse and whether there is a risk for the astronauts, and in our case we call them Marsonauts, whether there is a risk for the health. And basically what we found was that what we expected is that the main source of the bacterial community is the crew, basically the microbes you carry in on your skin, in your stomach, in your saliva. Like, that's also the typical community we found. Interestingly, we also found that duration of the confinement shaped the microbial community, and we also saw a potential impact of the cleaning agents. Also, we were able to identify some microbial hotspots. In this case, means basically we saw areas where there is like an accumulation of bacterial cells, but we were quite relieved that the overall bacterial counts were within the acceptable limits. So there are certain limits, for example, for the ISS, where there is a certain amount of bacteria allowed in a certain area or in a certain amount of air. And so therefore, we basically could say that they took the appropriate measures, and at no point, like, there was no risk for the crew. And that was basically what made us feel very relieved.
So what we're kind of looking at is how the bacteria on our skin and on our bodies and that we take into space, how they kind of fare in space and what they actually do.
Well, it's more like how they, like, where we can find them. It's not only the bacteria we bring in, like, on the skin, or it's always, like, on the clothes, bacteria are in general in the air. The facility we looked at, like, was sterilized beforehand, but every time you introduce something, there's always a risk that one bacteria was hiding and we didn't kill it, basically, beforehand.
And then, just from reading the study, you say there was a recent death spiral into Saturn by this kind of spacecraft that was explicitly to prevent the spread of Earth bacteria onto Saturn moons. So this kind of... This highlighted the importance of monitoring which kind of microorganisms that we might actually accidentally take into space.
Yes.
So could we take something into space and it actually has a long-term negative effect on the spacecraft and the kind of things we take in?
So, like, the area you're talking about is called planetary protection. And basically, there's two ways. So there is the forward contamination, and that is basically taking microorganisms on a spacecraft to Mars, Earth, Moon, or other planetary bodies. We also have clean rooms where the spacecraft is assembled, and they are also basically screened for microorganisms. But there is always like an acceptable limit of microorganisms that is allowed. However, we try to basically to sterilize it as much as possible. But we also know that we have found organisms, like, for example, bacillus, which are also found in this study, that can survive like long periods of desiccation, which would be like prevalent on Mars. They also can survive high doses of radiation. However, with regard to your question, like a negative effect, so far we cannot tell.
But so I kind of I think like the most easy situation we can imagine is what if we took like a negative bacteria and we took it to Mars or to Moon? Could that bacteria potentially thrive or something in these environments?
It is very unlikely so far, because if it's directly exposed on the surface, then it is very likely that the radiation, the UV radiation, is going to destroy the bacteria, and it will be killed within like seconds.
Yeah, it's not very hospitable on Mars or...
No, absolutely not. Like, they have a better chance if they are like somehow shielded on the spacecraft, like hiding between like metal parts, or if there is like a millimeter of dust, it's already sufficient basically to increase the survival rate. But still, it like there is no oxygen. We know bacteria that can grow without oxygen, but the majority needs oxygen, so that's like also an important factor. Then it's very desiccated. There is high salt concentrations. There is oxidative reagents that also basically interfere with the bacteria and basically reduce the viability. So it is a very hostile environment, and therefore it is quite unlikely that bacteria survive. Like, the majority of bacteria we know so far won't be able to survive. However, we cannot say with 100% certainty that they are all going to be killed.
So there might
be a survivor.
Yeah. But it's really more dangerous for the people on the aircraft or spacecraft than the actual planet itself.
Yes, in general, I think we also need to emphasize that not all bacteria are dangerous. We actually need them.
Oh, like, definitely, yeah.
In our stomach, like, they are very beneficial, and we basically need them for processing our food. There's also on the skin. If we would sterilize our skin, we would have basically skin problems. So there is lots of beneficial bacteria. But it is like this common perception that bacteria are always bad, but that is not true. So not every bacteria that might survive has a negative influence.
So from this kind of study that you've done, have there been any new questions that have been brought up from it?
Well, for us, it is basically how can we improve the spacecraft surfaces, for example. Like we've identified these hotspots, and now like this study helps to basically find mechanisms like how can we reduce them and basically where could we reduce them. Like we now pinpointed the locations where we should either clean more or like maybe use a different material to reduce the number of bacteria. Mm. Like for example, we found a lot of bacteria on the external surface of the toilet or also in the dining table or the tables in the individual cabin. And these are maybe like areas where we could make improvements.
So around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
So that was Jack Marshall's chat with astrobiologist Petra Schwitter about her studies on bacteria in space. After this, we have producer Sam Smith, who's going to be chatting to the Green Party's Golriz Garaman after the song, and she's coming in instead of James Shaw. Thank you.
At last, the filthy, filthy truth can be told, reaching beyond the reaches of time and taste, beyond Dirtbag every Monday. This is the show you've heard so much about, the show those establishment latte liberal vapors tried to stop, ripping off the twisted lid of local and international grunge, punk and garage, where the peasantry's no bounds.
Hello?
Piss off with your mild-mannered sensibilities, this is Dirtbag Radio.
Dirtbag Radio with Radley, Sam and Tam, three full-on dirtbags that won't give you Legionnaire's disease, Monday 7 to 9 on 95 BFM.
Christine, you always tell me I look good tonight, although I feel like death. Christine, you always ask me, let's go out tonight. The window shrinks with time. Drink a bottle of my courage, swim in my skin. Drink a bottle of my courage, swim in my skin. Let's go out tonight. The window shrinks with time. Drink a bottle of my courage. Swim in my skin. Drink a bottle of my courage. Swim in my skin.
Time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Yes, this week we won't be speaking to James Shaw, unfortunately, but we do have the newest MP for the Green Party, Golriz Garaman, on the line. Hi there, Golriz.
Hi.
How are you?
Oh, great. It's great to be on BFM and not on some 5 a.m. starting radio program.
I know, the time is much better. So how does it feel to be... You're a new MP. How does that feel?
I don't know that I feel it quite yet, but I feel really, really relieved because I kind of felt like I had the weight of the thousands of, you know, supporters and volunteers and everyone for the 2 weeks just waiting.
Yeah.
So it's been great for that.
Were you confident that when the special votes came in that you'd make it to Parliament?
I think everyone else was, but I was still quite guarded because, you know, so I went back to work.
Really?
I did more law, which was a bit crazy.
So you're New Zealand's first ever refugee MP. Does this weigh on your mind at all?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I never ran, you know, as that for that to be the goal. I sort of felt like I really wanted human rights expertise and constitutional law to be in our sort of lawmaking body. And I got to a point where I thought, okay, you actually have to be that candidate, which was a good lesson. But yes, and then when this kind of historic element came out, I realized quickly that I was going to have to get over my fear of tokenism. And I was talking to someone this morning about how, you know, Mojo Mathers wasn't the first deaf MP. She was just an MP.
Yeah.
But both Mojo and I, you know, and we've talked about this a lot, came to realize that we, you know, our presence, our story means something to different people. It means a lot, and it actually, you know, it props up a lot of the values that we want to prop up. So it is meaningful, and it is something that I feel really humbled by.
Is this a sign that New Zealand is starting to move forward when it comes to recognizing the achievements of refugees who might have come here from quite sort of harsh beginnings, I guess?
Yeah, I think it's about inclusion. I think it's, you know, just as, you know, as I've just said, I think I realise that representation in and of itself matters. It means that it's not just that we're recognised for our achievements, it's that we're also included in sort of leadership and in decision making. I think it's nice that New Zealand, and I keep saying this, it's so meaningful to me that we get to stand as this counterpoint to some of the other developments in politics elsewhere. So, you know, whilst in America, migrants and definitely refugees from, you know, the Middle East would have felt like physically unsafe when Trump was elected. And in Britain now, people, the hate crime stats just shot through the roof when Brexit happened. We get to sort of be this counterpoint of how it could be. So that's nice.
So you've got this very strong background in human rights law. What will you bring to your role as an MP from this previous experience?
apart from being very solution focused, because that's what working in the law kind of gives you. So I want us to move from identifying the problems and the injustices to actually effectively solving them. So whether that's in housing, whether that's in education or whatever it is. And I mean, the thing that I love about the human rights framework is that it's universal. So we all have rights because we're human, not because we've achieved some level of success or moral authority. And there's this recognition that all these rights are connected. So you can't actually say we live in a democracy and you have democratic rights if you are hungry.
Sure.
You know, if you don't have a home and if education is not inclusive. So that's hopefully what I'll bring.
I guess having been a human rights lawyer and going up against, a lot of war criminals, for example, going to Parliament will be a bit of a piece of cake for you, won't it?
Question time probably will be. The rest of it I'll have to learn on the fly.
Yeah. What are your main interests, aside from obviously human rights and sort of immigration, refugees, what are your main interests policy-wise?
So I have child rights expertise in there as well.
Yeah.
Which is a forum that I find really useful when I've done UN reporting, for example. It's a binding body of law, but also in lobbying. You know, we can kind of all agree that we need to take care of our kids in society. So I think, you know, focusing some of our policies back down onto sort of that child rights perspective will be my focus, and we've got child poverty stats that are, you know, again, through the roof. So I'd like to focus on solving those, and again, through a solution-focused vantage point. I'd like us to have a constitutional conversation eventually, because I want us to safeguard, you know, the Bill of Rights Act and the treaty and even our environmental protections. I think that's really part of New Zealand's identity, and I felt really sort of panicked almost under this previous government, where with just a bare majority, they could pass legislation, you know, even under urgency, to cut us off from some of those really fundamental rights. So I'd like us to start having those conversations.
Now, you are a strong advocate for refugee issues. Where do you think New Zealand is at with this currently?
Well, our quota is sort of near the bottom of how many other countries per capita certainly take. We're actually lower than Australia. I think most of the Kiwis would be really shocked to find in terms of doing our bit. And right now we are seeing the greatest humanitarian crisis since World War II, so certainly within my lifetime, emanating in the Middle East. And New Zealand really, we're not really doing our bit to help with that. But I think we have the spirit to do it. I just think policymakers haven't taken leadership. I think there's kind of support from across the board for us to step up and do that. We always have with international issues, whether it's apartheid or the nuclear free movement. You know, we like to lead on these types of things. So, yeah, I mean, the Green Party policy, which I'm really, really proud of, is to double the quota, then double it again, but do it over 6 years and do it whilst we put real support behind sort of refugee services so that people can integrate well and, you know, can have good health and education outcomes. Refugees actually really outperform in those areas, apparently. So I think we can do it.
So just one final question. What are you going to be doing the next few weeks, I guess, before Parliament sits again?
It's all a little bit of a mystery.
Yeah.
I'm going to Wellington tomorrow morning.
Oh, so you're still in Auckland?
Yeah, I'm still in Auckland.
Okay.
I held on. I'm a true Auckland MP.
Oh, lovely.
So hopefully, hopefully I'll get to actually keep an Auckland focus.
Yeah.
So that will be nice. So I'll go to Wellington tomorrow. I think I'll be there a few days and I'll do the induction that everyone else already did.
All right. Well, cool.
Yeah. So
thanks very much for your time today. Gauri, no doubt we'll speak again with you again, no doubt.
Yeah, hopefully.
Cheers, thanks.
Thanks, bye.
Bye.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.
So that was Sam Smith talking to the Green Party's newest MP, Gauri Kaaraman, about her new position. After this, we'll be joined by News Director Lillian Hanley and the University of Auckland, Auckland's Film and Television and Media Professor Neil Curtis. And we'll be talking about Duncan Garner's recent article about immigration and Kmart.
The Wire.
Mummy! Mummy!
What?
How do I keep on the cutting edge of great new music?
Well, when a DJ loves a record very, very much, they do a special kind of cuddle.
Mummy!
What?
Never mind, Mum. I've sorted it.
The answer to your problems. Follow 95BFM on Spotify for a lovingly curated collection of what's new, what's hot, and what's good in music. October features Björk, Liv E, Julian Dine featuring Lady Six, Bad Bad Not Good featuring Colin Stetson, and more. 95BFM's monthly Spotify playlist. Stay au fait.
You love music, right?
Yes, yes I do.
Then drive your stake into the musical landscape by voting for the 95BFM Top 10.
But how?
Text the word VOTE and your chosen band's name to 5395 or vote online at 95bfm.com/top10 before 6pm every Wednesday. Then join Pearl from 7pm as she starts counting them down. The 95BFM Top 10 with your host Pearl, Wednesday night 7 till 9 and always online at 95bfm.com.
Wire.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
Yes, you're on The Wire and I'm joined in studio by producer Sam Smith, news director Lillian Hanley, and University of Auckland film, television, media professor Neil Curtis. We also have
Aaron Marsh-Niapu on the line. Aaron, are you there?
Yep, kia ora.
Kia ora. So Aaron is one of the founding members of Racial Equity Aotearoa, and they have done a number of pieces recently about a tikanga Māori approach to immigration. But first, Aaron, we'll talk to Neil, who has written a response to Duncan Garner. Joel?
So just to give some context to the listeners, so news reporter Duncan Garner has recently written an article for Stuff where he complained about the packed line in Kmart and his experience about it, saying it could be anywhere from Southeast Asia. He went on to use it as evidence to fuel an anti-immigration article saying he wants to have a discussion around infrastructure in regards to growing immigration numbers. Since then, he sparked a lot of controversy on social media, causing him to delete his Twitter. Goodbye, Twitter haters, he said in response to people who called him racist. And he said those people clearly don't know them at all. So, Neil, you wrote a response to this. Can you tell me a bit about your response?
Hi. I was, when I read the piece, I was just very concerned about how he picked out particular ethnicities.
Mm.
And being an immigrant myself, a white man from the UK, I noticed that I wasn't there. Mm. And that I found really disturbing. If this was a general piece about migration to New Zealand, then why wasn't I included? Why were particular types of ethnicities and all non-white ethnicities singled out? And, of course, it wasn't just a queue. It was a massive crawling snake of non-white immigrants. So that was a trigger for me to write about why am I not there? Why am I not?
What's the issue around the use of the word snake?
There's a long history of a particular brand of politics relating ethnic groups and minority groups to animals. Right? There's a very long history of that. And I mean, we talk about a long winding queue as a snake. It's a regular analogy, but when you're talking about a particular minority and an ethnic minority, to liken them to animals, that has a history, right? And you must be aware of that. And certainly somebody working in a responsible job in the media has to be aware of that.
And what sort of other issues did you have with his article?
Well, it was basically that kind of absence. The problem with the article is there's no problems talking about migration and population, right? We have to have the resources, the infrastructure, public services that can support a population, right? So we have to have debates. But it wasn't about that. It was about targeting particular ethnic groups and finding them to be at fault and to blame. This is a bigger issue. This is a political issue about how we fund public services, about how we build big public infrastructure projects, which the National Party have not done for 9 years, right? And they've also used migration, I think, to actually kind of boost a faltering economy, right? So the actual issues we need to be talking about are why Auckland is under some kind of strain, and maybe why New Zealand is under strain. That was completely absent from the article, right? The real political issues we need to talk about were absent, and he just chose to pick on particular groups. But since then on Twitter, he's picked on white British people as well. So he's actually quite indiscriminate in his dislike of immigrants, I've found since, right? Mm. So those were the general things that disturbed me.
Yeah, and since he made that comment on Twitter, or his article, he deleted his Twitter, and he's in deleting his Twitter, he had some quite interesting some quotes that he made on a Facebook page. Sam, do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, so he posted I would describe it as a rant, basically saying that he's leaving Twitter, and well, here are some of the things he said. Just a few examples of the intolerance, hatred, and madness when a very small bunch of permanently aggrieved groupies start violently punching their keyboard. It's an awfully angry, abusive, and ultimately sad little hangout from hell. Twitter here is an angry child full of self-appointed wannabe intellectuals that believe they're truly superior. Twitter today lost me because Twitter and its people have no idea about me and my bilingual kohanga and kura kids, the immigrant neighbourhood I live in and my boys' school, where 55 languages are spoken. Goodbye, Twitter, and the angry aliens that populate your echo chamber. I suggest you book yourself in for anger management counselling. That's just some of the selected quotes from this quite long rant he posted.
So he wants to start a conversation, and the conversation is littered with discriminatory remarks about particular ethnic groups. And when people respond to that conversation he opened, he immediately shuts it down.
It's
unbelievable, really.
Yeah.
Aaron, did you want to jump in here and just let us know first what was your first response to Duncan's article?
Yeah, kia ora. I think just reading that, it's apparent that anyone that kind of comes across using a disclaimer, you know, I'm not racist, or, you know, whatever you're going to read after this is not intending to be racist, is obviously building it up to be some sort of xenophobic article. And I think it's quite obvious from the public outcry that everyone's pretty on point in pointing out his racism. I think what we're seeing here is actually a consequence, a wider public consequence of four kind of intersecting discourses, one being, you know, the Crown's colonization of Māori Ranga, Tiritanga and Kaitiakitanga, and just really the embedded white supremacy and white privilege in New Zealand. I mean, if we were going back even to the poll tax, that was quite discriminatory towards Asian migrants. That wasn't amended until 1944. Then you have the white exploitative and labor exploitation when it comes to border imperialism. And obviously, as one of the other panelists have mentioned, nationals, economic conservatism, that is pretty much on point with most Western policies at the moment, which further enables the degradation of proper infrastructure investments. So I think we're kind of just seeing the consequences of all of those discourses.
Mm. Kia ora. Neil, you actually mentioned in your article that tangata whenua are hosting us all. That's a quote. Aaron, can you sort of give us a bit more, bit of an explanation about the tikanga Māori approach to immigration that you've written about?
Yes, I think quite tellingly, there's been quite a void of tikanga Māori being talked about when it comes to immigration and migration. I think if we were to come from just one tikanga perspective, if we were to use the marae context as a metaphor, knowing that tangata whenua, the people that are housing the guests, the haukainga, so that's the relationship between tangata whenua Māori and non-Māori as the guests to this land. And it's really one that affords mana to everyone. So it's not one that kind of commodifies people that come to this country. It's one that kind of says, hey, welcome onto our marae, if we were to use New Zealand as a metaphor, the marae metaphor, you know, welcome onto our marae and, you know, get involved with our tikanga, get involved as one of us. And I think that's the type of discourse that is missing from the immigration discussion at the moment. And I think that one, that it's totally based on values that we've been that we've held true for the past 200 years.
And what do you think about him using his bilingual kohanga and his kuta kids and the fact that he lives in an immigrant neighborhood as a excuse to sort of get out of accusations of being racist?
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, it's just as easy as saying, oh yeah, you know, I have a Chinese friend or I have a Māori friend, you know, I can't be racist type of thing, or I wear a Pounamu necklace every day to work type of thing. What we really need to do is cut all of the, you know, this kind of on the surface so-called multiculturalism or biculturalism, actually have these hard conversations within our communities, because at the moment where we are heading towards is something that is probably going to look quite similar to how America's race relations are at the moment. And it's because we're not dealing deeply with the conversation. It's just kind of surface level.
I might put this to both of you, but in the sense that you've got, perhaps Duncan inherently is not a racist person, right? He may not be a racist person, and he's been targeted as a racist person, but what he's done is made racist statements that add to this rhetoric. Do you think that there's a sort of ignorance or sort of historical amnesia, perhaps, in terms of his position as a white male broadcaster with that power? Does he have a responsibility, but two, does he have the ignorance that allows him to say these things and not necessarily, because he may not have any understanding as to how that would be damaging? Does that make sense? Neil, you go.
Oh, yeah. I think to write something that can be described as discriminatory or racist doesn't make somebody a racist, right? If you then say to them, look, that is discriminatory and racist, and they say, oh my God, I'm sorry, why? Can you explain to me? Oh, okay, I said that wrong. I'll try not to do that again, right? That's important. But if what's even worse here is that he said this, he's had some pushback, and he's completely refused to engage in the possibility that he might have been discriminatory and racist. That's the really troubling bit, I think. The fact that he shut everything down and refused to countenance there might be an issue here. That's poor.
Aaron, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think the fact that he kind of shut it down and he's kind of, you know, pulled away from social media kind of shows that he wasn't one really interested in creating a conversation or to continuing any conversation after his article. I totally agree that, you know, you can make those types of statements and doesn't necessarily mean you're like the next Don Brash or whatever, but it does show a degree of privilege that someone, you know, white middle class male broadcaster can make these kind of statements and kind of, you know, throw a tanty and get out of jail for free card. And I think it's through education and talking to and within our communities that we will be able to shape our community perspectives quite differently within the next 20 years.
Kia ora. Is there anything you, either of you, want to add? We've got to wrap it up.
I just wanted to reiterate Aaron's point about in the US and the UK, we're stripping more and more wealth away from the Commonwealth, if you like, or the public, right? And the politics is scapegoating foreigners, migrants, welfare, the poor, right? We cannot go down that route. That is the wrong route to be going down. And that's what Duncan Garner's doing.
Mm. Kia ora. Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Aaron, and thank you, Neil, for coming on the show today. We really appreciate you guys' insights on this issue.
Kia ora. Thank you.
Kia ora.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
So that was a chat about Duncan Garner's recent article complaining about immigration, on which was sparked by a busy Kmart line. Finally on the show today, a recent report has shown that university enrollments have reached the lowest point in a decade. This is partially due to a higher cost of living, less support for older students, and a change in the value placed on tertiary education. Producer Leonard Powell spoke to some members of the public about this.
Yeah, thanks, Joel. I went around Auckland University campus this morning and began by asking the very kind people who had time to chat with me for their thoughts on the decreasing of student allowances for those over the age of 40 and the fact that those over the age of 55 are not allowed to take out a student loan.
I think older students, when they're coming back to university, they're trying to sort of sort themselves out, get a bit of better life. So I think that we should be giving them benefits like that. It's pretty rude to, you know, let me have a student allowance, and then some 40-year-old's not allowed to get the same thing. So I think everyone should get it. People are living till like 80, 90, 100 nowadays, so if you're 50, you're not old, you should still be able to, you know, that's enough time to give back to society and all that stuff. So yeah, you should be giving everyone a student allowance.
I think everyone should have the same opportunity. I mean, if you're older and you're trying to retrain from maybe an antiquated industry, it's a perfect opportunity to get back into education and pick up some funding to help you get there. It's important that we upskill everybody, not just young people.
Okay, I don't want to sound like controversial or anything. I kind of understand where they're coming from. Students that are 40 and over or 55 and over, you'd kind of be expecting that they've been working up until then. But I don't think that they should be. It should be disallowed. I think there should be possibly like tighter measures for like to allow them to have their student allowances. But I don't think it should be, they should like ban it from them. If you come to university, everyone should be on the same level playing field, regardless of your age, gender, and whatnot.
What's your whole view on students in general and just the financial situation with coming to university?
Am I allowed to swear? Oh, yeah. It's bullshit.
I think it's pretty tough for students now. I mean, especially if you're living in Auckland, there's a lot of cost and not a lot of money at the moment. And I think the downside is that a lot of students are spending a lot more time in part-time jobs, which is taking time away from their studies. So I think there's definitely a difficulty at the moment with getting the balance right.
I think the standard to actually get student allowance is, or whatever the free one is, the one you don't have to pay back, the standard to get that's pretty interesting. I don't really know how that works too well, but I think it's not working for quite a lot of people.
So I'm originally German, and so I've got a German passport, so if I go over to Germany, I'm allowed to study for free, and the only thing I will be paying for is living costs, and that's like expensive in itself in Auckland. And so it is a struggle. I mean, I've said to so many people that are coming out of high school, if you have the option of not going to uni and doing an apprenticeship instead, like, go for it, because uni is so expensive. Tertiary education should be free, or at least very low cost, so that not many people go into it just because it's like free education. Like, the standard should be higher. Like in Switzerland, the standards for tertiary education, university, are so high, so not a lot of people do it, but they have so many other options to go for. But yeah, I definitely think that course fees should definitely be either lower or free completely.
Whoever's in charge of it should be coming up with ideas. It's their job. I suppose in terms of the one that they're giving away, I guess they just want to make it easier for people to get it. I mean, you know, students, everyone wants to really go to uni. It's pretty fun. So just make it easier for people to go to uni. Give everyone a student allowance. It's not that expensive. It's only a couple hundred bucks a week or whatever it is. So yeah, I reckon everyone should be able to get that. Just why not?
A free ride maybe isn't always the answer for everyone, but at the moment it's so expensive for students, and they come out with massive student loans. Just the balance doesn't seem right at the moment. I quite like the idea that people get some portion of their studies paid for them, perhaps guiding people towards careers that the country needs economically, to kind of balance the free ride with the productivity for the country. I also think that universities should have a bit more responsibility in ensuring that students are financially being a student is financially a viable option, and I guess some of that comes from government funding, and some of it comes from prioritisation from the university's perspective.
And Joel also spoke to New Zealand Union of Students Association President Jonathan Gee about his thoughts on the issue.
So, a recent study has shown that tertiary enrollment is at its lowest point in a decade. You have previously mentioned this is partially due to a high cost of living for students. Is this the major issue surrounding enrollment, do you think?
Yeah, so there have been rising costs over quite some time, and, you know, even just last night, we heard a story around rising food prices. So, you know, you see that there are a whole lot of rising costs for being a student in New Zealand, yet student support has failed to meet up with those costs. Actually, you know, the current government has gradually defunded student support over the last few years. So, you know, I think that definitely is a contributing factor.
And what other issues do you think there are contributing?
Yeah, so what you say, I think if you dig down into the statistics around the decline in tertiary enrollments, one of the biggest drops is in the 40, over 40 age group, where you saw from 2008 there was a 6.7 proportion of tertiary population over 40. Now it's down to 3.6%. So, in terms of student support, in the last few years, the government restricted student allowances for those over 40. So you kind of see that actually, that signalling there by the government has resulted in that decline in that age group.
So the funding was dropped, do you think, because the government sort of presumes that they can fund it themselves if they're at their age? Is that right?
Yeah, I think quite possibly. There are arguments that obviously, you know, in ever-changing future of work, we should be supporting lifelong learning and, students, people studying in tertiary education at all ages. So it's there's a bit of a tension between that and trying to decrease student support on the government side.
Why do you think there is a sort of like perception that study is only for sort of people in their 20s?
I think it's probably just in terms of a life stage. So, you know, a lot of, usually it's the normal life process that after you graduate from school, you go into tertiary study, you go into some form of study. That what we're seeing is obviously there for a lot of people, that's not possible, either because they've got, you know, high costs or, you know, they come from poorer families where they want to, you know, they'd rather be earning than learning once they leave high school. So you're seeing that a lot of people, after they have families, are going into tertiary education because they didn't have the chance to get into it when they graduated from high school.
And so recently a bunch of companies come out, I think Trademe was one of them, and they're saying that they do not require for people to have degrees for them to hire people. Do you think this sort of change in thinking about degrees, like maybe I don't need one if I can get a job anyway, is another contributing factor to people not enrolling?
Yeah, I think quite possibly, and I think actually, I think it was a fair point that those companies had raised. I think that's a signal that's being sent to tertiary education and to the government that actually, in terms of the tertiary study that we go into, it needs to be adapting. It needs the skill, you know, it needs to, provide us with the right skills. In order to adapt to the ever-changing future of work. As I said, I think it's a bit of a signal there. I think the other thing that I would say about that as well is that, I think we need to remember the public value of tertiary education. It's not just about getting a job at the end of it. It's actually, you know, there's been studies around the world which have said that tertiary education improves life outcomes such as better health over time, reduced incarceration rates, more stable work in general. That actually, you know, the more people that participate in tertiary education, the better the society that we have.
Do you think there's sort of an element of privilege there where people who are sort of come from stronger financial means and are more likely to study, therefore they'll have, like you said, those benefits, higher about health outcomes and stuff like that? Do you think that that element of privilege is there?
Oh, yes, totally, I think. And, we're of the strong belief that tertiary education should be a right for all and not a privilege for the few. But actually, when you're reducing financial student support in terms of, you know, those over 40 or reducing access to student allowances, actually you are creating more of that inequality there.
And I suppose you sort of, if you're coming from a place where you don't have the means to study without sort of looking towards employment at the end, then there sort of almost might not be a point to doing it if you sort of need the job to survive.
Oh, exactly. And that's what I'm saying in terms of, you know, a lot of students are thinking, oh, I'd rather be earning rather than learning.
Mm.
And also, I guess, you know, again, students are telling me as well, a lot of students or my the presidents around the country are telling me that some of their students are saying that they go into their first year of study, that they're from a family of, no history of tertiary study. They go into tertiary study for their first year. They see the amount of debt that they incur. They freak out and they decide to leave. Tertiary education and just go into work. So actually, you know, that level of student debt, which is the result of tuition fees as well as living costs, is a big factor in terms of tertiary education participation.
Mm. Well, what do you think can be done to change this, to sort of encourage people to study and stay with it for their own personal development?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, the first step is actually increasing student support. As I said, it has been, there has been a gradual decrease in terms of access to student financial support over a number of years under the current government. So I think that's definitely a first step. I think a second step in terms of ensuring that that tertiary education is accessible to all people or to all school leavers in particular is that we need to improve careers education. I think at the moment careers education at the moment is inconsistent, it's patchy. It's not personalised as well, and it's sort of skewed towards universities, unfortunately. Whereas actually, you know, there's huge potential in the polytech area, as an example. So actually, I think, you know, improving careers education will help in terms of getting students to understand where they want to go in terms of their futures, and knowing how tertiary education can play a part in that.
And do you think anything can be done to actually change the overall mindset that study is for employment rather than personal development? Like, is there anything we can do to sort of change that perception over time?
Well, I think at the moment, sort of the way that we look at tertiary education, it is around, at the moment, it's in this paradigm that we're looking at it as our talking about our future job prospects. And I think, you know, we need to come back to the conversation that actually universities and politics, they're legislated to be the critic and conscience of society. That students, you know, when they go into tertiary study, actually they're being part of a community of scholars where they're engaged in public debate, that parts and that adds to the democracy of our society as well. That's sort of being forgotten in the conversation of tertiary education. So I think we need to start moving towards it again and actually saying that there is huge public benefit and not just private benefit to tertiary study, and that, you know, we should be embracing that.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
That was The Wire.
So that was NZ Union of Student Association President Jonathan Key talking about the dropping numbers in tertiary enrollment. And that's it for The Wire today. Thanks to producers Sam, Jack and Leonard. Thanks
Pleasure.
To Lily for your contributions. And thanks to everyone who texted in. We had a few texts come in, especially in regards to the Duncan Garner story. Someone texted in saying, "What is all of this white privilege crap? That is racist," and they capitalized "is." I think that
well, through history, the white people have traditionally been the oppressor, and people of color have usually been the oppressed.
I think you have to be pretty blind to sort of not realize the advantage you have as being a white person in today's society, Lillian.
Even as a white man myself, I recognize that.
We actually have, there was four white people on that panel itself, and Aaron, who is Māori, and Samoan. But you see there's that imbalance there. But I think also in this position too, it's actually good for white people to be calling out Duncan in that sense. In terms of privilege, it stems from a long history of institutional power where white people have had that power, and you can still see the effects of that, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And we had another text in saying too many people crying over words. And I think words are really important, and I think that's very important to be crying over them and calling people out. And if you're being called out, to acknowledge the things that are being said, unlike Duncan Garner, who was called out and then deleted Twitter because he didn't want to have a conversation about it.
And then he blamed Twitter, you know,
which
for
is actually quite an important platform where people can have a voice. But in the sense of, words are important. Like, we as broadcasters, I say we because we also have this responsibility, but Duncan too has a responsibility to be careful, very careful about what he says, because it can be damaging to people. And the sense that even further, like what stems from this article is a sort of allowance to talk about people in this way and to kind of demarcate this kind of, there's a group of Southeast Asian people. Like, he actually in the article names a whole bunch of non-white countries where these people are from. And so you've got Neil, who's an immigrant himself, but can walk through the mall and say, and be considered a Kiwi in quotes, and anybody who is of colour is of different descent can then be kind of pushed outside of that normal Kiwi, again quotes, category, which is really dangerous, and words add to that.
And I think by just like disregarding it, like Mikey earlier disregarded an offensive Twitter post because he said it's Twitter, it doesn't matter. But I think it does. I think it's really important, and Twitter sort of shapes the zeitgeist.
Another person saying how Duncan's part Māori.
Oh.
Well, he did mention in the rant how he's got Māori children and et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
But I don't know where that fits, though.
No.
That doesn't excuse
you to be racist just because you are Māori.
That's like, I'm racist,
and as
but...
Adjust what we've been saying in terms of he is a white passing male, so you still receive all of the benefits and privilege of that.
Exactly.
That's it for our show today. Thanks to everyone that came on. We had Neil Curtis, Aaron Marsh Nyapu, we had Lillian Hanley, we had Gowriz Garaman, and we had Petra Schwitter. Up next is The 1-4 with Hannah Rennick.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.